Hello, America. Welcome. Gary Bell, Brad Pollack. This is Legal Anatomy of Current Events. You know the drill. We take current events in our country and we break them down for you. We give you the legal story inside the story so that you understand the facts, you understand the law. So when you hear a story in America, when you hear a story in our country, it could be about Trump. We're covering Trump today, but it could be about the indictments on another case. It could be about the indictments in Santa Fe, New Mexico. We give you the legal breakdown. What does that mean? I tell you what, we break down the law that they're prosecuting the people with. We give you the defenses. We give you the prosecution side, and we do it so we can educate you. Today we're talking about Trump and the New York fraud case, civil fraud case, where he was ordered to pay with interest over $500 million back. And so what is that case really about? What's the breakdown? What's the legal story inside that story? And we're going to tell you. Here we go.
As one small step for man.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
Legal Anatomy of Current Events, preparing for launch. Legal Anatomy of Current Events. Launch sequence started. T-minus 10. Internal power green to go. LES ready for ignition. T-minus 9. 8. 7. We have ignition. 5. 4. Commit for launch green. 3. 2. 1. We have liftoff. Legal Anatomy of Current Events. All for you. Now on the air.
All right, Gary Bell, Brad Pollack, Legal Anatomy of Current Events. We're glad to do this show for you. We're talking about Trump today. We're talking about the Trump civil suit in New York for damages, for inflating, allegedly inflating. And then they said he did inflate the value of certain assets or all of his assets or part of his assets under a statute. So, first of all, ask yourself the question. That sounds kind of weird, doesn't it? Think about that. The Attorney General for the state of New York sues a private individual or private company, and there were many people named in the lawsuit, sues them for inflating assets on financial statements, which they weren't turned into the criminal authorities, they weren't turned into the, and the banks didn't do it, and the banks didn't complain, basically. There was one banker that testified, but it didn't complain. So what is the statute? How can they do this? You know, and we're also going to get into procedural due process today and substantive due process. I think you're going to learn something about that because there's a statute, right? And so what does the statute say? And I think you might agree with the statute. So just for a minute, put Trump's name aside because those of you in favor of Trump, you're going to be saying and criticizing the case, and those of you against him are going to be wanting to know some things about that. But put Trump's name aside for the case. This statute. It's called New York Executive Law, Section 63.1, 63.1, basically. What is this law? Okay, so I think you might agree with this. If you put Trump's name aside, the statute basically says, and I'm paraphrasing, whenever any person shall engage or engages in repeated fraudulent or illegal acts, repeated, or otherwise demonstrates persistent fraud or illegality in carrying on or conducting transaction of business, then the Attorney General can bring a suit against that person and ask for certain relief and remedy, including money damages, including what's known, we're going to teach you today, called disgorgement. Disgorgement. You made money, we want it back. So if you just take Trump's name out of the equation, I think you might agree with that statute, right? Think of it like this. Think of it like this. You go to see an attorney. You're in New York City. You go see an attorney, and the attorney gives you all kinds of advice, and you think that's great. And you go home, and you're following that advice, and you're following that advice, and you find out that person isn't even an attorney. They're not licensed. And you haven't paid them any money yet. And so you say to the attorney, well, you're not even licensed. You didn't tell me that. And the attorney says, well, it's no big deal. You weren't harmed. Think about this. You go to a psychiatrist. You got issues you want to talk to a person about, a psychologist, a counselor. But in my example, a psychiatrist. They talk to you. They don't prescribe drugs for you. But they can, but they don't. And then you find out they're not really a licensed psychiatrist. And they've done this repeatedly. They've done this to hundreds of people. So I think you can see the purpose of the statute they passed in New York. It's called the executive law, New York executive law, 63.1. You know where I'm going with the next one. What if you get on an airplane and the pilot flies you from New York to Washington, D.C., you land, and you find out that's not really a licensed pilot? And so the pilot's argument is, well, nobody got harmed. You didn't harm me. I didn't harm you. Nobody got harmed. But it's the repeated fraudulent or illegal activity that the statute is aimed at. It's aimed at deterring fraud. It's aimed at deterring deceitful action. Deceitful action. So now you can reinsert Trump's name into the picture, okay, for either for him or against him. And, Brad, let's start with a common law. Common law, you had to prove there was an intent to defraud, an intent. I'm doing something with intent to cheat you. And you also had to prove harm. There had to be harm, economic harm, usually. I lie to you. I sell you a piece of real estate. I don't even own the piece of real estate. I take your money. I forge documents. I take your money. So that's common law fraud, but you had to have the intent to defraud, and you had to have the harm. But in this statute, you don't have to have either intent or harm. You just have to have the repeated acts.
Well, we can talk about common law we want, but the problem is, in this case, Trump is prosecuted under a statute. And common law is not a statute, and statute's not common law. The statute may try to address certain things in common law, and at the same time add to it other features that makes it illegal on what was happening. And so in common law, I'm not so sure Trump wouldn't have won because there was a situation where it was hard to determine that he actually harmed anybody, although I think he did, because I think that they clearly showed that if he had properly valued the properties according to what they should have been valued at, he would have had to pay up to $160 million, I believe it is, of additional interest to the bankers and to the people who made the loans. So I think they were harmed. I think the people who had stock in the banks that made the loans are missing out on $160 million, I believe.
Yeah, $160 million.
Dollars worth of dividends. So I think there was harm in this. I think that the additional harm is the confidence we can place in investing. If I put money in the stock market and I invest, I expect the stock market to be following certain rules that have been laid out to make sure the stock market operates appropriately. That'd be the same thing with the bank. If I'm investing in a bank, I expect that the bank is acting appropriately, which, by the way, makes me very upset when I hear the banks are saying, well, we know we get false financial statements and we still make loans on false financial statements. We know that the assets are being puffed. We know that they're not accurate. But as long as we get paid, well, we're okay with it. If we don't get paid, I suppose we'll do something there. That's like, shutting the barn door after the horse got out for a number of farmers and cattle people. They'll
that's
understand.
That's my line. That's my line about the horses in the corral in the barn.
Yeah, it is your line from Oklahoma. But the bottom line is, I'm saying, I don't want to wait as a shareholder in a bank for a billion-dollar loan or hundreds of millions of dollar loans to go south, to go bad, before there's enough harm that the people who lied on their financial statements or misrepresented their financial statements, before those people are held accountable, because there's a certain deterrence factor that I would expect. You'd be seeing a number of financial investors now looking at what happened to Trump, saying, maybe we want to redo those financial statements. Maybe we want to redo those financial documents and have them more accurate so that what's on record is more accurate, and we're not faced with the potential that somebody somebody like Letitia James decides she's going to start looking at the next investor, the next person. Why was Trump looked at? Well, we know he's a high profile person, and you know, in life, if you want to be a high profile person, you should be ready for high profile examinations and for people watching you. And if that's the path you choose, I mean, he chose to go down this path, and that means he's got to try and live it. Finally, with respect to harm, you know, that's like the police officer who sees the guy who's drunk driving every night when he goes home from the bar, and never stops and arrests the guy or never picks him up. And he says, well, there's no harm. He got home safely. He got so many. I know he drove drunk for 10, 15, 20 miles, but there's no harm. So what you're saying, Mr. Police Officer, is we have to wait till that guy or that lady runs into somebody and hurts them and actually sends them to the hospital or maybe kills them before you're going to hold them responsible for driving drunk. That's not the way it's supposed to work.
Right, and that's the difference in the common law and this New York statute. The common law, as we've preached forever, is the case law. We inherited our law from England. That's why it's called the common law. So certain law was already decided by courts. That's common law. Statutory law is passed by the legislature. That's statutory law. So under common law, for fraud, you had to have the intent to cheat somebody, intent to deceive somebody, intent to defraud them, the intent. And you had to have harm. The statute is different. The statute is designed, and one of the most important elements of the statute under which Don Trump was prosecuted, if you will, in this civil case, was the fact that you have to have repeated illegal or fraudulent acts in carrying on or conducting business. Repeated. So it might be a crime if you have one incident. I mean, if you lie on your financial statement, if somebody lies on their financial statement and it's material, that can be just one time. That can be a crime. But this statute is to deter people, and we gave you some examples at the top of the show, an unlicensed pilot, an unlicensed attorney, unlicensed psychiatrist. You know, yeah, you would object. I thought I was visiting with a – I thought I was on an airplane with a licensed pilot, for crying out loud, and I found out I wasn't. So this is repeated conduct, and Brad, your example about the drunk driver is a good one. Now, let's talk about this statute. So when Don Trump, Brad, says, well, wait a minute, some of these entries I didn't intend to mislead anybody. I didn't even know about them. They were prepared by somebody else. I mean, they weren't mine. I didn't adopt them. So I didn't really know. That goes to the intent. But intent is not so much relevant as it is under the common law.
Well, again, you know, the law that he's being prosecuted under puts the burden in, and puts the responsibility on him to make sure it's correct if he's the one signing the documents.
Right, because you can file your tax return and say the same thing. I didn't know.
That's exactly right. I mean, I can do a number of acts where, you know, I have somebody else sign the paper and work, and I say, well, you know, I didn't sign it, or I sign it, and I don't take the time to make sure it's accurate. Well, guess what? That's his job. And when he says, well, my empire is so large, and my holdings are so huge, and that what it takes to determine the value is so huge that I really can't do that, then he needs to take a step back and either get back to where he can do it, or he has to get the right people that are going to be working for him to make sure it is accurate and to make sure that what he says is accurate when he's using that paperwork or those values to acquire multi-million and multi-billion dollar loans and to acquire multi-million and multi-billion dollar buildings. And once again, it's not a matter of whether or not you got the money and you did what you were going to do with it and you got the money back and you got them paid back. What it matters is that for people to invest in different businesses, for people to be able, the small people, like you and me, Gary.
Right.
I mean, we're not billionaires.
No.
So, you know, we're looking going, okay, if we want to invest in the stock market, we want to be able to make sure that the people who are operating the stock market are playing by a specific set of rules that assure safety of not only their money, but my money too. And that's the same thing when I'm investing in a bank that's making a $1 billion loan to Donald Trump. I want to make sure that the bank is playing by the rules and that the guy borrowing the money is playing by the rules so that my investment is safe. Not well, we'll worry about it when your investment is no longer safe and you've lost it. That's not going to work. And so if as a result, you go out and buy and hire a bunch of shady people or a bunch of negligent people who don't take the time to make sure the representations they're giving on certain forms are legal and are correct and are accurate, then, you know, you're putting yourself at risk, and you should be put at risk because ultimately you're the one that's going to end up with the benefit. It's not the people who put together those numbers for you. It's you who signed the document and authorizing or saying it was accurate.
You know, you made a good point about the stock market, Brad, and we did a previous show on Legal Anatomy of Current Events here on insider trading when the Goldman Sachs broker was found guilty of insider trading. It ruins the level playing field for the average investor. I'm investing my money, for example, in the stock market. You are. And like you said, we rely on certain rules. But when somebody trades on insider trading illegally, done on insider trading, when they do that, it distorts the playing field. And it takes money from people like you and me. Now, in that show, you can still listen to it. We covered there's a legal way to do so-called insider trading. There's a legal way, and there's an illegal way, and we taught you. But what are we teaching you today? This New York statute, you know, and we also did a show on the Alvin Bragg indictment of Donald Trump. We did a show on that, and we showed you what the elements of that statute were. This is just for an example. Let's just reflect back. On the Alvin Bragg case, where Donald Trump is being sued and charged criminally, they have to prove that he made a false document, and they had checks written that were false, and with the intent, a false document with the intent to commit a future crime. Not actually commit the crime, but with the intent to commit the crime in the future. Okay? So here we're talking about you don't have to prove intent. Under this statute, for the over $500 million against Donald Trump, it had to be repeated events, repeated acts. Now, listen to these words in the statute real carefully. It had the word fraud or fraudulent means. This is what the statute says. It means it's under false pretense, false pretense, a false promise, any deception, any misrepresentation, any concealment, suppression, false promise, or unconscionable contractual provisions. Okay, so that's the gravamen. That's the main part of the statute. So, Brad, this statute is meant to deter people. So the argument by the Trump allies or the Trump people that say, well, there was no harm, no foul, there doesn't have to be. And before we're finished with this show, we're going to talk to you about how Donald Trump might be able to appeal this thing. But to appeal, he's got to post a bond, and we're going to talk to you about that just a little bit. But there doesn't have to be the intent to defraud. There just has to be repeated activity that's deceitful, fraudulent, not true, false pretenses, and that sort of thing. And so, Brad, now we've got the judgment.
Right. Well, So let's make sure we understand. The rule wasn't just that, hey, don't be incorrect. The rule was be correct. Don't be inaccurate with your accounting numbers and with your assets. Be correct. And that's what the law in essence says. It says be correct and be accurate and know that you are. Don't just slough this off to somebody else. And if you don't, then there's going to be some pretty heavy penalties because the object of the law in this particular circumstance wasn't just, well, don't be wrong. It was you be right. And when it's saying you be right, it puts the onus on you to be right, and it puts the onus on you to make sure that you're right. Now, some of this stuff that we've read, the valuations were so egregious that I don't understand how Trump or his kids or any of the sophisticated people we're talking about, who have a great deal of sophistication, couldn't have known this is wrong. And so, you know, when the requirement is to be correct, or else you're going to face some heavy penalties, and guess what? You better be correct.
You better be correct. You're listening to Legal Anatomy of Current Events. I'm Gary Bell, along with Brad Pollack. Our law firm is Bell & Pollack. We're out of Denver, Colorado, and we're glad to bring this to you. I want to flip this a second. I want you to think about this for a second. Everybody says, well, Trump inflated the value of his assets, inflated them, inflated the square footage of his executive penthouse, inflated that. Well, what if Mr. Trump had undervalued his properties? Stay with me on this. What if he undervalued them? And you said, well, geez, and then there would be no repeated fraud. There'd be no failure. There'd be no deception. There'd be no... What if he undervalued them by half, which means he paid half of his real estate taxes that he should have paid? I mean, if a property's worth $100 and you value it at $50, you only pay taxes on the $50 valuation, not on the $100 valuation. So if he undervalued the property, then it's a tax situation, which put burden of the taxes on the average ordinary person because he's not paying what he should be in taxes. If he overvalues it repeatedly, consistently, with deceit and deception, which they proved, then... You can't say no harm, because as Brad said, you're getting away with interest and issues. Now, this judgment was for $335 million. With interest, that's $454 million. But listen, folks, the story doesn't stop there. The bond, what's the bond going to be? And Brad's going to explain a bond to you in a minute. The bond to stop the execution of this judgment, pending an appeal. Stop it. For Trump to stop it, he has to post a bond, which Brad will explain to you in a minute. But the bond has to be for the $454 million plus more interest. So the more interest goes up to $557 million. Now, Brad, explain what a bond is and how that stops people, the government, from going to collect this and executing on his assets, bank accounts, property, etc.
Well, normally you're going to talk about two different bonds. You're going to talk about either a cash bond or a surety bond. And these are the normal bonds, and what's going to happen is you're going to, if you want a cash bond, which I think one of his attorneys said he has the money, he's just going to go post these. That's what I believe she said back
Didn't come true.
Or she said, you know, this is no problem for him, he's just going to go post a cash bond. Nor, that means he's going to take the amount of cash that the bond has to be in the amount of, and usually the bond is going to take into consideration how long it might take for the appellate process to run, and it's going to add interest at the legal rate onto that judgment to make sure, because if he loses it on his appeal, then the money's immediately payable. And so normally the cash bond is you got the cash, you take it down, you put it into the registry of the court. It's being held there. It might be on a special account, depending on the amount and how the particular court handles it. And it's going to be, and that money is going to be held into safe banks, which, by the way, it's going to be into safe institutions, which may or may not be using some of that as assets to show what their value is worth. And it's going to be sitting there, and it's going to be held as money that can, if the case is lost, the money comes out and it gets paid to the rightful owner. If the case is won by Trump, it gets out and it goes to the rightful owner also. Now, then you can have what's called a surety bond. And a surety bond is a bond that, and you can have that, actually a property bond too. So we can have cash bond, property bond, then we go to a surety bond. And a surety bond is where you get a company that agrees that it will pay the money in the event you lose the appeal.
The $557
million. $557 million, and that's where you go to an insurance company, or that's where you go to a bonding company, or that's where you go to a surety company. And you go to a company that does this, or it can be an insurance company that maybe doesn't do it. In this case, Trump went to 30 different companies. So going to 30 different companies tells you he went to different companies saying, I want you to agree, company, that if I lose this appeal, you'll pay the money. They can look to you to pay the money, and normally to be able to set that kind of surety, the company that's doing the surety bond has to put up assets that the court can readily obtain in a cash form. The court doesn't want to have to go sell the property after the on a bond. He wants it in a cash form. That the court can collect that money from them and can pay it over to the rightful owner, and then it leaves it up to the surety company that posted the bond, such as the insurance company, to now go, and it's up to that surety company or the insurance company to go get the money from Trump. And so, in that case, Trump would have to probably put up cash and real estate in one form or another that far exceeds 557.
All right, let's cover. Let's break it down to its simple parts, Brad. So you explain you can put cash. He can put cash in there. He can put $557 million of cash that is fully bonded and go do his appeal. Number two, he can put property in there, $557 million of property, and he can go do his appeal.
He'd probably have to put in about $600 or $700 million.
Right, exactly. So then he can go do his appeal. If he wins his appeal, he gets his cash back. If he wins his appeal, he gets the property back, right? And so now we go to a surety bond. Now, think about this, folks. Look at this transaction. He's asking a company to guarantee to the court $557 million. Well, what do you think they're going to take from him up front? They're not just going to take 10% of that and then bet on the come and hope it all works out. Brad, I think they're going to take not one-to-one, not $557 million, but maybe 2-to-1 or 3-to-1, three times $500 million of property assets to secure the $557 million.
I would expect that to be true. And depending on how desperate Trump is for the money, maybe a determination of how much he's willing to put up as of ours is 1-to-1, 2-to-1, 3-to-1. Worth of protection to the bonding company, and how much the bonding company would have Trump indebted to it as a result of what happens. And that's why it's so concerning that you have a man in his standing with this kind of situation, because you look and you go, he could be our next president. He's got a great deal of influence. And the question is, if he gets somebody, he's gone through 30 companies, probably the most of which are legitimate, where he's gone to legitimate companies who've turned him down. So if he goes to somebody else that lends him that money or puts up that bond, what kind of favor does he now owe to them? And what does he have to do for them to be able to pay them back for what's been done for putting up that bond, and especially if they end out having to pay on it, so it has to be in my mind, the courts have to look when any company comes in to put in a $550 to $700 or $800 million bond. That they have to look at the company, and they have to make sure the company doing the bond is a reputable company.
Right.
Now, maybe if it's a cash bond, maybe if he can just borrow that kind of cash, then you've got to worry about to whom he owes the favor. But those are all other areas of concern that I'm not so sure are right for this show, maybe another show, but because there's a lot of conjecture. But the bottom line is, Trump needs to find a way to bond this judgment.
Okay, but the legal clock is ticking. What does that mean? The judgment entered in, there's an automatic stay. Anytime a judgment gets entered, it depends on the state that you're in, but there's an automatic stay. That meaning you don't have to post a bond. Let's say the stay's for 30 days. That whoever is the judgment creditor, whoever won the case, can not collect the money. They have to wait until the automatic stay is expired. But the clock's ticking. It's about to expire. He doesn't have a bond. So, Brad, he ends up on D-Day, and there's no bond. Then they can start collection proceedings, and that means filing documents. One's called a list pendens, filing documents against his real estate, seizing bank accounts, garnishing bank accounts, garnishing wages, garnishing assets, garnishing liquid assets, getting orders and subpoenas to produce them, and that sort of thing. So it's a nightmare for him. It's a nightmare. So you must, what can he do in between? He can ask the court for an extension for the automatic stay with no money posted. Don't know if the judge would give it to him or not. He could ask the attorney general for a counterproposal. Hey, I'll bond $300 million or $200 million if you would just give up me bonding $557. That takes an agreement. So there's things he can do, but the clock is ticking. And he's going to run out of time.
Maybe when he does that. Agreement. This is kind of a side joke here.
Yeah, is this the American idiom now? Are we in the American idiom?
No, and we'll get to that later. Maybe when he does that agreement to or goes to the court to say, here's an agreement where I can pay you later, he can give him a list of his assets that he gave originally to the banks and say,
need to give you a financial statement. You already got every one for the last 10 years anyway.
You already got my financial statement. Right. And so, you know, maybe you can just pull that out and use it. And you know, this isn't funny really in a way. And, you know, we can make light of it because we're not there in those shoes. And, you know, Trump, once again, as I stated at the beginning of the show, he put himself in a high exposure form of life and on track to be high exposure. He placed himself in a position for people to be looking into this kind of stuff, and he had to be prepared for it. You know, if somebody started asking me if I wanted to be in those shoes, I'd be saying no. And I don't want to, but he chose it. So, you know, this is something now that he has to work out, and it'll be interesting to see if he works it out.
It'll be interesting to see. Now, let's talk about an appeal. We're going to give you a little constitutional law lesson here. And when you go to law school, you call that con law. Con law is constitutional law. And see if these words, if you've ever heard these words before in your life. Are you ready? It's a test. Wake up. Here we go. We hold these truths to be self-evident. What does that sound like? That all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, that comes from the Declaration of Independence. Why are we talking about that? Well, we're going to talk about Don Trump's appeal right now. In my view, if he appeals this, if you're a lawyer looking at an appeal, you got a couple of ways to go. He wants to get it to the United States Supreme Court. So he wants to declare how the statute that he was prosecuted under to be declared to be unconstitutional. If it's declared to be unconstitutional, Brad, what happens to the statute?
Well, the statute gets thrown out. It's unenforceable. And anything that was done under the guise of the statute
is gone.
Is gone.
Yeah.
Period. So Trump doesn't owe any money.
Okay, but to get to the Supreme Court, you got to bond it, which is why we're talking about the bonding the judgment. Then you get your appeals. But what's his argument going to be? Now, let's break this down to simple math. To me, it's one of two arguments. Why did I read you the Declaration of Independence? The Declaration of Independence says life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but the Constitution says life, liberty, and property. Life, liberty, and property. So you cannot be denied your life, liberty, and property in this country without due process. Well, but wait a minute. There's more than one kinds of due process. What do you guys mean? You guys are blowing my mind today. We're talking about due process. There's procedural due process and substantive due process. What does that mean? Okay. So if I'm going to do Don Trump's appeal, I'm going to look at the weakest thing that happened. And I don't think it's going to be the numbers. I'm not going to argue to the Court of Appeals that the numbers are wrong because I think I'm going to lose. I think the numbers were right and in evidence and proved. But I'm going to argue that this statute is unconstitutional, because if the United States Supreme Court or an interim court goes with me and declares it to be unconstitutional, Brad, then it's gone.
You're done. You're out.
The statute didn't even exist.
That's right. And of course you want to say it's not constitutional. Now, you know what would you say is unconstitutional about it? Well, you know, I understand Trump's lawyers have a theory. One of the theories is that it is unduly harsh, that it is an inappropriate deprival of his property, and it's unduly harsh. And what they're saying is that it's beyond the limits of what should happen if you put in a financial document false information that results in no harm to anyone. Maybe you should be able to do something, but not something that in essence can take away a person's entire assets or freeze in a person's
entire
assets. And
that's where I'm headed. That's a substantive due process argument. So let's break this down for you. Let's educate you right now. A procedural due process argument on appeal probably not going to work here, because procedural due process means you get charged and you have a notice and you get a hearing, a trial. Well, you had it. So procedure, he got the procedures. But a substantive due process means something different. A substantive due process means Don Trump was not given substantive due process. What does that mean? That means his property, remember, life, liberty, and property. Life, liberty, and property. His property was taken away from him without a sufficient reason. Now I'm going to give you one example, and I'm going to turn Brad loose on you. Think about the fact that if you have two children, and social services comes in and they want to take them away from you, and they're operating under a statute. And so they said, we're going to take these kids away from you. Here's your notice, and you're going to have a hearing. So you have a hearing in front of a judge. That's procedural due process. You got due process. You got what you're entitled to. But substantive due process means we got to look at the statute itself and determine, was there sufficient reason to take your kids away? Was there sufficient reason? You got your hearing, but was there sufficient reason in the statute to take your children away from you? Well, or is there sufficient reason in this statute to take Trump's property away from him? That's substantive due process.
And does the punishment fit the crime? You know, you've got to look and say, does the punishment fit the crime? In this case, so this is how much money you're having to pay, and this is the formula that was used. You know, it'd be going back to my drunk driving example. You get caught drunk driving. Nobody gets hurt. You're just caught, pulled over for weaving and drunk driving. And you go to court, and they charge you a $500 fine. Most people hearing this would say, well, that sounds right. Let's say you get caught for driving 10 miles an hour over the speed limit. Just a simple 10 miles an hour. Nobody in this room has done
that. I'm just saying, but go ahead.
So in that case, do you charge the person $500 for driving 10 miles an hour over the speed limit? And you know, nobody gets hurt from it. Nobody is put in danger of it. You're just driving 10 miles an hour the speed limit on the highway. That would sound like an excessive fine at that point. You'd be saying, well, I could see 50, I could see 100, maybe 150, but certainly not 500. And if you look and say, well, you just got punished the same amount as the drunk driver who drove down the road, you start saying, well, wait a minute, that doesn't seem correct. That doesn't seem right. So you need to put those standards together in something like this. Now, when I look at it, I will be the first to admit that I was not privy to any of the case that was going on. But when I'm being told that if he'd have would have properly valued his assets, it would have been about $186 million more in interest alone, I'm looking, going, well, maybe this punishment fit the crime, because in this case, you know, it's $440 million we're talking about, and you know, you do have to identify that you're going to have, because the interest is the interest is the interest. You know, I don't want to debate that. If you owe the money and you haven't paid it, that's a different situation too. But you know, if you lied or you were so negligent that you didn't properly value your assets, so much so that you're saving $168 million, then, you know, having a result from that of having to pay $440 million can sound right.
It can sound right. So look at it this way. I'm gonna go to Roe versus Wade in a minute. I'm just going to get off on a little tangent here. But if I were Trump's lawyer on this appeal, I would not argue procedural due process, you lose. I would not argue the numbers were wrong. I think you're going to lose. I would argue that the statute's unconstitutional because it does not afford substantive due process. There's not a sufficient purpose behind the statute. There's not a sufficient reason behind the statute to punish somebody like this for the evidence in there, therefore declare the statute to be unconstitutional. And if it's unconstitutional, it's what lawyers call void ab initio, meaning it's void from the beginning, meaning there is no judgment, there is no collection, there is no, and then the bond gets released and Trump gets his money back. And then if you want to get really legal mental gymnastics today, I think, my opinion, I think Roe versus Wade, which is now overturned by Dobbs, I think Roe versus Wade was a substantive due process decision by the then United States Supreme Court. Hey, the word abortion is not in the Constitution, so where did the right of abortion come from? There was sufficient reason. There was therefore substantive due process because there was sufficient reason for the court to declare the right of an abortion. And now it's been overturned. All right. Gary Bell, Brad Pollack, our law firm is Bell and Pollack. We're out of Denver, Colorado. And you know what's coming. We end every show with Brad's American idiom. I can hardly wait today. And then I'm going to give you the quote of the day. So, Brad, what do you have, I can hardly wait, for the American idiom today with this topic, with Trump?
Okay, sitting around the table, we said that Trump could be saying, I fought the law and the law won. But I'm
well. That's a good one.
I'm not so sure the game's over yet, or it's over yet. So
no, game's not over.
He hasn't necessarily the law hasn't necessarily won, but he is arguing and yelling, "No harm, no foul." And when he's saying "no harm, no foul," that means, as far as the people beside him, other billionaires who are putting the money down, they are making a law unto themselves. So this is a law unto themselves, but with regard to what they've done, they've left a paper trail that has allowed Ms. James to lay down the law and enforce the letter of the law. So I thought I'd give you guys that little circular idiom.
You do it every week.
That you needed to know about. So
that's incredible.
You know, just remember, it's the long arm of the law that might hurt you if you're not really very careful.
Wait, what's that other one? Penny wise and pound foolish. What is that? Is that, did I say that right?
Yeah.
Did I say
yes,
it right?
Yes. And in this case, he might have very well been a penny wise and a pound foolish.
And a pound foolish.
You know, and that's pretty good idiom too for what he did. He saved $168 million, but now it's costing him
$500 million. Now, I've got the quote of the day, and hey, I've got a good quote for today. This is a good one. And it goes like this, and you can apply it to Trump if you want to. A happy person is not a person in a certain set of circumstances. That would be him. A happy person is not a person in a certain set of circumstances, but a happy person is a person with a certain set of attitudes. That's a happy person. All right, Gary Bell, Brad Pollack, our law firm is Bell and Pollack, Denver, Colorado, Legal Anatomy of Current Events. We break it down for you, and we want to anatomize your mind. See you next week.